Welcome to another edition of the Activist Agenda. I'm Russ Belville, and joining me here at Delta 9 Studios, we have investigative journalist and friend of the show, Angela Baca, in studio. Hi, Angela.
Hey, Russ.
I'm so excited to have you here because you just produced what I think is one of the best investigative pieces on the mechanism of activism. You know, what it takes for grassroots groups and national groups and funders and all of the politics that go on at a local level. We'll talk about that. You've recently published a 4-part series in Huffington Post that took a look at this, and I encourage everyone to check that out. Do you have that linked on your website?
It's at the top of my Facebook page. All 4 will be linked right there. So facebook.com/AngelaBaca.
And that's Baca with 2 C's, B-A-C-C-A. Check that out. Very, very deep dive you took into what's going on in the state of Ohio, and we'll get to that, but I wanted to start off with the Joker to my Batman, Kevin Sabet, and the folks at Project Sam, because this is, while the piece is largely focusing on Ohio and what went down with its medical and its legalization plans, what went down in the legislature and so forth, in part 4, you get to the meat on Project Sam that I've been searching for and digging for, and that is their connections and what's fueling Project Sam. And for our listeners that don't know, that's the Smart Approaches to Marijuana. It's the leading anti-legalization lobby out there. I call them Project Samuel, Smart Approaches to Marijuana Use Except Legalization. And Angela, let's just start there with Project Sam. Kevin Sabet's the head of this. We see him on TV all the time. What is it that you found out about their funding and what's got them going?
Right. Well, the people who've been going after Sabet, yourself and myself included, the minute he called himself the quarterback of the anti-legalization movement, yeah, we all targeted him. And it made us overlook his partner, who's Patrick Kennedy, the nephew of former President John F. Kennedy and the, yes, son of Ted Kennedy. And Kennedy's connections will really kind of spell out the bigger picture of what's going on with Project Sam. There has already been previous reporting showing that they have affiliations with the Community Anti-Drug Coalition and all of the organizations that receive those federal funding. They've also been working with pharmaceutical companies that provide opiate drugs.
Okay.
But it seems that
and the fixes for opiate drugs too.
Absolutely. One of the biggest ones would be Vivitrol, which is a once a month injection that costs $1,000 a month. They've been lobbying heavily to get it required in prisons, covered by Medicaid. It actually could kill you if you take it and use opiates. You can cause overdose and die. So it's actually a deadly drug, and it's a lifelong solution to the problem of opiate abuse.
So Kennedy is a former congressman, and some of the background on him, he comes to this as the recovered addict. He paints the picture of his addiction to painkillers that led in 2006 to wrecking, like, not once but twice in his car driving while high. In the second instance, in the Capitol, Washington, D.C., Capitol Police gave him a ride home, just a ride home.
Right. He was a huge embarrassment to the Kennedy family and their name. And I think that he really needed a way of turning that around and spinning it in the media as something that's propelled a more noble life's work. And mm-hmm. I think that's what's really driven what he's been doing in recent years with Project Sam as well.
So they're connected. Kennedy's connected with CADCA and the pharmaceutical companies. How?
Kennedy has a 501c3 group called the Kennedy Forum, which is explicitly funded by opiate-producing pharmaceutical companies, companies that provide drugs that treat opiate epidemics, and the companies that distribute the drugs themselves. All of them are funding his life work of curing addiction through the Kennedy Forum by looking for pharmaceutical solutions to cure addiction.
So this is why this is part of the shell game that's going on here, because Sabet will obviously, oh, we're the little guy, we're fighting against big marijuana, the well-funded pot lobby, and we're just the citizens working so hard to stop addiction. And if you take a look at their finances, as you did, there's not much there, is there?
No, and that's intentional. You can look at their finances and see that on the C3, I think they had around 30,000 and around a couple hundred thousand in their C4 last year, which is pretty much nothing, but they are coordinating the messaging sponsored by the pharmaceutical companies that then goes to these community level groups that receive federal funding. So it's really all these loophole kind of ways of roundabout financing and and shaping policy.
Yeah, we found a slice of this here in Oregon in 2014 when we were trying to legalize, and I dug deep, got some open records requests, and found Sabet was getting paid $3,000 an appearance plus expenses to go to 13, at that time, cities around Oregon for a education tour. This is being paid for by state and county anti-drug education efforts, but seemingly the education was all how bad it would be if we legalize, and only took place in 2012 and 2014 when we were trying to pass legalization, not the odd numbered years. So the shell game here is, sure, Sabet and Sam can show they don't have very much money coming in, but when all of their expenses and their honoraria are being paid by these anti-drug coalitions, being paid by our tax dollars, and now how do we link that in with the pharmaceuticals and Kennedy?
Well, it's interesting, too, and to kind of jump from Kennedy is to Sabet himself. Sabet was the trustee of the DEA Education Fund, which is a 501c3 that the DEA is using to push out messaging. I don't know why that's ethical or legal in any way that they have that, but he was someone who determines where that money goes from. Most of the money coming into the DEA Education Fund was coming from Bayer Pharmaceuticals and the chain drugstores of America, which represents Rite Aid, Walgreens, and all of the companies that dispense opiates.
Yeah, made opiates in the beginning. So we've got Sabet as a DEA trustee directing money to go to education efforts that then sometimes bring Sabet to a state to get paid.
Exactly.
Oh my. All right. So you see how
it's all the same money, just through different little shells and networks, but it gets things where they need to go.
And so the larger picture you're saying here is where Kennedy fits in and what he's doing. He's got a lot of still allies in Congress that he works with and is pushing for a lot of these pro-opioid overdose laws. You'll get the Vivitrol out to the people and so forth, right?
Well, despite the fact that neither Sabet or Kennedy has any sort of medical training to speak of, Kennedy is now in charge of President Trump's opiate task force, and they're basically taking all of the failed policies that are killing people in Ohio and moving them to a national level. And it's really still in the name of profiting the companies that caused the opiate epidemic in the first place.
Yeah, these companies overprescribe, get the people hooked on the opiates. When they get hooked on the opiates, can't get them through their insurance or whatever anymore. They go to the streets and get, you know, God knows what that sometimes has fentanyl in it. They die, cause a big public outrage. Now, hey, we've got the solution. We've got these Vivitrols and anti-opioid drugs that we want to sell as well.
And opioid constipation drugs and all kinds of other side drugs for your opiates.
Oh, yes. The OIC, that terrible commercial on TV.
It was in the Super Bowl a couple years ago, yeah.
that's the one I'm thinking about. So what a nefarious scheme they've got here. So this ties into why you would find Project Sam and people like Kennedy being so against medical marijuana. And what we've been finding in study after study, one that I just reported on last week, once again confirming, people kick the, you know, it's 2/3 of the patients that kick their opiate pills if they've got regular access to medical cannabis. This is why you hear Sabet and Kennedy and their Project Sam pushing this idea that, marijuana is a medicine if we can extract the cannabinoids from it and put it in a pill or an inhaler. But my goodness, you can't grow it yourself and stop taking our pills.
Yeah, it's absolutely about the money. Hands down. And as a patient myself, I had I have Crohn's disease, and I've had 2 surgeries to remove portions of my colon. The last time I did it, they've shot me up with as much Dilaudid as I could possibly want. And you know what? It is really fun to do heroin in a medical setting like that. However, I rationally know that I can't continue doing that. And I do see how when you take a single compound drug like that, you can become very tolerant to it, mm-hmm. and need increased amounts to get off of it. Every single time I've come home from the hospital on those drugs, I've completely detoxed myself using a ton of marijuana every time to get off of it within a day or two.
Yeah.
And that means a lot to me, especially because with marijuana, I don't have to increase the amount that I use to get the same effect. I can just switch up a strain because it's genetically diverse. It's always a different blend of cannabinoids and terpenes in every different formulation.
Yeah, I'll attest to that. I remember coming out of a surgery that I had, and they had me hook up to the morphine thing with the button. You could push the button, but you'd only get the morphine once every 15 minutes. And within half a day, I could sense 14 minutes and 55 seconds like anybody. And I was ready to push that button. And so when you bring that up, it brings to mind one of the things we hear our opponents say, people like Sabet and Kennedy, that lament that, you know, marijuana gets you high. Can't have people getting high. I'm like, have you tried an opiate?
I mean, I've always been fascinated by drugs, and as a patient, I've had the opportunity of doing lots of different drugs in a clean medical setting. And I do them experimentally when I'm in there. The pharmaceutical drugs are really hard and really harsh on your body and dangerous. I took one for nausea one time that actually burned my arm going into the vein. It was really painful to take when I could have just taken a hit off a vaporizer or a joint. It would have just gone away. So if we aren't allowed to start somewhere safer with marijuana, then we're more than likely to get hooked on a pill like an opiate, like fentanyl. So marijuana threatens that quite a bit.
Well, let's take this discussion now to a state that could really use more marijuana, and that is Ohio, where the focus of your four-part investigation was. And that this is a story that dates back even before the attempt to pass legalization in 2015, as Ohio has been a hotbed of activism for decades and has well-entrenched grassroots activist groups there. Give our listeners a little taste of what you found in Ohio and how this is, you know, how we've seen the forces of the Project Sam types, the legislature kind of scheming to make this the most pharmaceuticalized, one of the most pharmaceuticalized medical cannabis programs in the country.
Well, Ohio, despite being kind of smaller and in the Midwest, is a really important state when it comes to understanding the culture and demographics of the United States. It's the seventh largest state in America. It's almost equally rural and urban, but all of its demographics, down from race, gender, color, economics, almost completely perfectly mirror the United States at large. It also is a very important bellwether in our presidential elections. Yep. As goes Ohio, so goes the nation. Every single time Ohio picks a president, the nation goes with it. And so we have seen there that there's a lot of money coming in and out every 4 years for the presidential elections. There's a lot of big money and big players there all the time because it's such an influential place. And while activists who are dealing with medical problems usually have pushed to get themselves safe access, the money has been building outside of Ohio, and it's really complicated the process on the ground there. Mm.
So we date back to groups that you reported on, Ohio Rights Group. We have there's such a cavalcade of acronyms that came through here of all these different grassroots groups. And you mentioned, as Ohio goes, so goes the nation. I've had the opportunity to report on elections for marijuana statewide since 2010. Each one that's gone down, I've traveled to a different state, met the activists there. And as I'm reading your piece on Ohio, I'm like, yeah, saw that in California. Oh, yeah, saw that in Washington. Oh, that sounds like Colorado. Let's explore that angle a little bit and what you found as far as the grassroots eating their own, I guess, you know, the circular firing squad.
There's a group of people who've been involved in marijuana legalization since before it was popular, before there were headlines, and they all tend to kind of know each other across state lines. I worked for one of them, Ed Rosenthal.
Yeah.
And so before everything started getting as big as it was, we had a very tight-knit network. And I feel like those groups definitely had a lot of ownership to the culture and the cause. Mm-hmm. And as more and more people have come in, there's been an identity crisis for sure. And a lot of money flooding in and changing people's loyalties and where they actually stand. And now we find that nobody can agree on any form of legalization.
Yeah. And this was brought to a head in 2015 with the Responsible Ohio campaign, which did as much everything wrong you could possibly do wrong from the perspective now that we have of legalizing in eight states, and culminating most egregiously in Buddy the mascot, which, you know, you got a male bud, which is oxymoron.
You know, Ian James really tried to convince me that that is a gender neutral bud because of the way his name is spelled. But if you look at the body, it's clearly male. There's no top. There's nothing to cover the top half. Yeah, you know,
Buddy had some pretty nice pecs.
Yeah, Buddy looks like a man with a head of a booger.
Yeah. There you go. So that was 2015, the issue three, which the big contentious part of the issue three was it wrote in an oligopoly to control marijuana growing, cannabis growing. The 20 wealthy investors who contributed $2 million each, I think, was that it?
It started out as 10 investors. Okay. It turned into 10 investment groups because they started filing with the SEC and trading out grow units before they even made the ballot.
Yeah, yeah. So, but the thing that turned off the majority of the activism community, and I'm sure the grassroots activists in Ohio, because I got to meet a lot of them too, was writing in this, the kind of buying the regulatory capture on the cannabis production side. It went down in flames. like a 2-1 vote against it. And I was there in,
wait, and I loved your commentary on that actually.
Thank you. Thank you. I was there in 2015 when it went down. And then what unfolded was kind of the vacuum, what got filled in that vacuum from, well, it went down in flames, but not because legalization was unpopular, but because of this type of legalization was unpopular. And oh my God, look at these numbers for medical. Take us from that point.
Well, right. You have to remember exactly where we're at this time. The responsible Ohio election was November 2015. So in the vacuum of that, we're already in the throes of a presidential campaign. And so everybody knew that if there was something on the ballot in Ohio in 2016, it could likely bring out voters for Hillary Clinton, because the Democrats were already sure Hillary Clinton was going to be the nominee at right. that point. So they wanted to do what they could to keep Hillary off the to keep medical marijuana off the ballot, to prevent a Democrat win, because Kasich was running for president.
Hmm. And as goes Ohio, so goes the nation.
Exactly.
Right. So this is a case of and we're seeing, past as prologue in Oklahoma right now. 2018, Governor Mary Fallon's talking about keeping their medical, which is already, they're already going to vote on medical in Oklahoma, but not on the, they don't want it on the general election ballot. They're trying to move it to the primary where it wouldn't damage Republican prospects in any way.
Right. But the thing about that to remember, and I think is interesting, is that this isn't explicitly a Democrat issue at all.
Yes.
Anymore. If you look at Trump supporters, the vast majority of them support marijuana legalization, even. I know, because they trolled me hard after the election.
Yeah, there we go. So we had the 2015 issue 3 go down, but it had huge numbers for its medical marijuana support in Ohio. This is where the grassroots wants to put together, at this point, a rights-based medical cannabis type of...
That was always kind of the roots of the grassroots campaigns, was rights-based. They could put something in their amendment in Ohio that would say that everybody has the right to use, possess, and grow at their home. The state itself can regulate commercial in whichever way it sees fit, but this is a human right, and mm-hmm. you can't do anything to impede that. Those were easily dashed. That was why Responsible Ohio came in, because they saw that coming into the ballot itself and really being a game changer. And they didn't want to see that happen state to state. If you look at what's happening in Midwestern and East Coast states, they're almost always oligopoly licensing now, which mm-hmm. is monopoly-like, but with a few players.
Yeah. And so this is where then to step into the void, Marijuana Policy Project is, look, we can put together medical marijuana in 2016. Now you got Ohio politicians not wanting a vote there in 2016. And then the legislature steps in, and this is where it gets just nefarious.
What happened with MPP is quite bizarre, and they stopped answering a lot of my questions when I was asking about it. I specifically was looking for their 990s or federal tax returns for their C3 and their C4 in 2016, because they were routing all of the money from the Ohio campaign into their national account and then paying it back into the Ohio campaign, so you couldn't see who the real large donors were. I really wish they would release that, because it would give a lot of clarity to what happened in Ohio last year.
Very interesting. And this is where politically the Ohio legislature, this is kind of a strong arm that we tried to use in Oregon, actually, which is, well, hey, look, you can work with us to put together some sort of legalization or medical that you like, or the voters can pass it. And so the MPP was used as a threat because, hey, we can put this thing on the ballot. It'll bring out the more progressive turnout. And the Ohio legislature says, well, we better beat them to the punch.
Well, it certainly looks that way.
Yeah, we beat them to the punch and put our own type of medical. And once they pass that medical through the legislature, now MPP feels like, well, it's got the legs cut out from going for any sort of initiative, and they bail.
Right. And they took one of their most controversial activists from Ohio and put them up into Michigan now. And some of the trolling on the internet that was happening surrounding that activist is now happening in Michigan as well.
My goodness. It's just a huge, huge story. I encourage everyone to check out Huffington Post. It's a 4-part series written by Angela Baca. Your Facebook, Angela Baca, B-A-C-C-A. People will be able to find it, and you can get all of these. It's a lot easier to follow in print, actually.
Set aside a couple hours if you're going to read it in full.
Exactly. Angela, thank you so much for coming into the studio and talking about all this.
Thanks.